Thank you, my friend, and hi, everybody, again. My name's Ian, and I'm a recovered alcoholic and addict. If you take a look in your workbooks at Step 12, we're going to talk about Step 4. Ooh, scary. It's the spooky step, right? Where we make a searching and fearless, no half measures, moral inventory of ourselves. There's a famous bodybuilder who said, everybody wants to be a bodybuilder, but nobody wants to lift those heavy-ass weights. And everybody wants to recover from alcoholism and addiction, but I've met a lot of people who didn't want to write a searching and fearless list of their defects, search their fears, search their resentments. But we're going to see how we can do that by making it easier. In the next half hour or so, we're going to see how to take the fourth step. We're going to see about how quickly we can take the fourth step so we can get on to that all-important business of getting rid of these defects, sharing them with another person, getting God to remove them, and of course, being well on our way to helping others. Step 4 is a process by which we begin getting right with ourselves, and it has to begin right away. If you look at page 12, it says next, that is right after the step 3 decision, which some people sitting in the room right now may have just made, right? That's great. Next, we launch out on a course of vigorous action, no half measures, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Or there may be some of us, like me, who've attempted it several times and let it linger and didn't finish it and then started drinking or getting high or whatever instead. That is absolutely what is going to happen if we don't launch out onto this course of vigorous action. I don't know if you've ever seen a rocket launch. It doesn't go up slowly. And we can't take this step slowly, which means we've got to make it simple enough to do quickly so we can get results quickly. Now, our decision in step 3 is obviously a vital, crucial step. Vital in the sense of life-giving. You bet it is. But it's not going to have any permanent effect unless it is at once. That means now. That means fast, followed by a strenuous effort to face and, more importantly, be rid of the things in ourselves, in me, which have been blocking me from the kind of relationship with my maker that I need if I'm going to have him directing my thinking and I'm going to stay sane, right? My liquor, my drugs was just a symptom. It's just a symptom. I needed to get down to causes and conditions. And to do that, I'm going to take inventory of them. That's what this personal inventory is all about. This is step 4. We're going to take stock honestly. We're going to search for the flaws in our makeup, which are causing my failure. We just talked about that in step 3. My problems arise out of myself, right? It's my self-will that's blocking me off from the kind of relationship I need to have with my maker. Okay, so what is that stuff? What is it for me? I need to take a look at that. And that's just like what we do when we take a warehouse inventory. We're just going to walk around and basically mark off what we find. It's going to be easy. So we're convinced that self, manifested in various ways, is what's defeated us, right? That's the essence of our step 3 decision. All right, that's easy to say. So let's consider its common manifestations. And there are 3 that we're going to learn about. 3 common ways in which the self-centeredness we've just been talking about manifests and that we can learn about. Manifestation number 1, resentment. The all killer. It is the number 1 offender. It destroys, we are told, more alcoholics and more addicts than anything else. That means, if you think about it, it destroys more alcoholics and more addicts than alcohol and drugs. And I absolutely believe that's true. Cameron talked about people he's known who stone cold sober have killed themselves because they could not live in the world as it really was, consumed by resentment or fear or whatever. We're going to talk about all of it. But it is a killer. It can kill me stone cold sober because from it stems all forms of spiritual disease. All forms of spiritual disease. Because resentment at its core is really anger and hate for my fellow human beings, right? That's what it really is. When I think about resentment, I'm loathing another person around me. And that is the root of all spiritual disease. Because how can I live in a loving, spiritually enlightened way if I'm carrying around hate for everybody around me who doesn't behave exactly the way I think they ought to behave? That's going to be tough. Take it from me. You probably don't have to take it from me. But I certainly felt that way when I lived that way. I was one of the most angry, resentful sons of bitches you've ever met. And it was killing me. It was worse for me than drugs and alcohol. And those things were pretty bad for me. So you agree with that? If you do, you can circle yes in your workbook. If not, well, very proud of you. Okay? Now, the big book has, from the little Romanette pages of the doctor's opinion all the way through page 164, a big list, causes and conditions, defects of character, you know, shortcomings, flaws in our makeup, whatever you want to call it, that are cited. And Cameron has helpfully in the workbook gathered them all together. Everything from pride, probably the granddaddy of them all, right? Every character defect has pride at its root somewhere. All the way through things like prejudice and, you know, cynicism, impatience, fear, all these things. You can take a look at this on your own time and see which of these kind of resonate with you. But the point of doing step four is when we look at our resentments and our fears and the harms we've done to others, we may uncover some new information about ourselves. So we've been spiritually sick, like I said. Now, here's a sentence that is just one of the most action-packed, high-octane sentences in our whole book. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. There is so much going on in that sentence. Let's just pause for a minute and really make sure that we understand it, okay? I understand I'm physically different from other people because when I drink or when I take drugs into my body, I have a different reaction than other people. I don't know why. I always have. And it makes it unsafe for me to drink safely. Can't do it, right? But of course, that's not my only problem. We already learned that in step one. I'm also different mentally from other people, which is that no matter how hard I try, I cannot stop doing these things even when I really want to, right? Which is that mental problem is then what causes the physical problem because I start to think I can do this safely. My mind goes into that curious mental blank spot, and then that triggers the physical allergy and I'm off to the races, right? But of course, I can't fix that physical problem. I can't change that. And I can't seem to address the mental problem with things like therapy or, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, things like that, because if that worked for me, it would have worked a long time ago. But when my spiritual malady is overcome, right, when I stop having these manifestations of self-centeredness that block me off from my maker, I straighten out mentally because he's directing my thinking and he doesn't miss. And if my thinking is straightened out, then I straighten out physically because I don't take drugs or alcohol into my body. So the fact that, yeah, I would have a different reaction from them today, just from other people, just like I did years ago, it'd be exactly the same. But it doesn't matter because they don't come into my body. You see? So spiritual malady is overcome, we'll straighten out mentally, and that'll straighten us out physically. Very, very important concept to understand. We alcoholics and addicts are sensitive people. You ever have anyone tell you that? You ever feel a little sensitive? Boy, that certainly was true of me. And it takes some of us. I'm still outgrowing that serious handicap, that liability. It's a process, in other words. It's not a single event that's like you're going to walk out of here and you're never going to be sensitive again. It's going to take a little longer than that. But here's how we get started. So in dealing with our resentments, we're going to set them down on paper, right? Pen to paper. And we're going to start with one of the easiest tasks that anybody ever asked me to perform, which is to list the people, the institutions, or principles with whom I was angry. Man, that's all I thought about most days, is how mad I was at my ex-wife, at this friend of mine, at this person at my job, at the government, everything, at both American political parties, you name it. I was mad at everything and everyone all the time. Make a list of all the people that I think are fucking up? You bet I could do that. That's easy, right? And if you take a look in your workbook at page 14, you got a little example here, right? Resentments under column one, people, institutions, and principles towards whom I'm angry, right? So in the big book, they give the examples of, you know, Mr. Brown, who's trying to sleep with the author's wife, Mrs. Jones, she's a nut, whatever, but right? Just a simple list of who we're mad at, right? And then we asked ourselves why we're angry, right? And if you look at this example, you know, what are these people doing that's making me mad? And if you look at the examples here on the sheet that you're drawn from the big book, not one of these examples is longer than 20 words. Not one of them. This is not a time to tell a long, boring story about the many wrongs that have been done to you. But Mrs. Jones, I love this one, just says she's a nut. Says it all, doesn't it? What else does he really need to say? She snubbed me, right? My wife, I'm a mad at her, and she likes Brown. Two words that capture, boy, I bet a lot of resentment is packed into those two words. How much more do you really need than that? Because this is, again, we're just writing down in a basic kind of inventory-like way, you know, damaged goods, check, okay? So you do that, and if you keep it that simple, also you can do it faster, right? It's a little tip from me to you, okay? And, you know, in most cases, it's going to be found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, that is our financial security, my money situation, or our ambitions, or our personal relationships, including our sexual relationships, are hurt or threatened, right? That's column three. You can just sort of note that. What part of this, why does this behavior by this person make me mad? And with the example of, you know, with the wife that likes brown, well, it's obviously threatens a person's self-esteem, doesn't make you feel that good, threatens your sexual relationships, kind of affects your personal relationships with brown, right? One way or the other, whether you like it or don't like it. So it makes you sore, makes you burned up. You ever feel burned up? That's all I ever felt is burned up. So that's what we do on our grudge list. We just set opposite each name our injuries. We note whether it's our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal sexual relationships, whatever has been interfered with. We go back through our lives and you just write these, you know, initially all we're doing is just writing these three columns, right? Nothing counts except for thoroughness and honesty. Sometimes I talk to people and they'll ask, or we'll be discussing, how many names should I have on the list? There's no magic number. All that matters is thoroughness and honesty. Okay. Now, we're not trying to manufacture artificially hundreds of names. We'll talk about that a little bit at the end of the instructions. But what we're really asking is, what's killing me right now? Who is making me mad right now? Because chances are, if you're like me, I might be mad at 100 people, but there are a few people who I would like to chop up and put in my refrigerator if I thought I could get away with it. And taking inventory of the anger I feel toward those people and getting some relief from that, getting a new perspective on those people, is going to be so much relief compared to if I think about some bully from, you know, third grade, you know, getting over my resentment toward that person, which I probably haven't thought about for decades until you asked me to do this exercise. There's going to be a difference there, right? So we're really looking for the big stuff. Nothing matters but thoroughness and honesty. And when we're finished with that, we're going to take a look and consider it carefully. Okay? No half measures. Now, putting out of our minds at that point the wrongs that other people have done to us in column two. Now we're going to do something. See, because to conclude other people are wrong is about as far as I ever got. Right? I already knew that part. Okay? So I write my little grudge list and I'm like, yep, this just proves the world is full of assholes who just don't know how to treat me. But now we're going to do something that I had rarely done, which is I'm going to look for my own mistakes. Okay? And that's what we've got here in column four. Now, the book doesn't reproduce this, so this is interpolated by Cameron just to give us an example, right? We're going to resolutely look for our own mistakes. And you can see with the example of the resentment to Mr. Brown. One of the things we're mad about is, well, he told my wife about my mistress. Well, gee, what do you think our mistake in that situation might be? How did we set ourselves up to be hurt on that one? Maybe by cheating on our wife? Maybe if we didn't have a mistress to tell our wife about, maybe we wouldn't have gotten hurt in the first place. Just an idea, right? So we can note that and so on and so on. We just go through and we note, look, where have I made decisions based on self that have placed me in a position to be hurt, right? Where have I been? Selfish, dishonest. Ooh, dishonesty will place you in a position to get hurt every time, doesn't it? Because if your lie gets found out, people get mad at you and you start to think you're not being treated right. Where have I been self-seeking? Where have I been frightened? We'll talk a lot more about fear in a minute. Now, that's what we list in our fourth column. And again, it's helpful to just, you know, just note the, you know, essentials of the mistake here. Because what you're going to learn, if you're anything like me, is that most of us tend to make the same mistakes over and over and over. I was mad at a lot of people, but when I looked about the things about me that were making other people mad, it was like the same handful of things over and over, okay? Now, a situation might not be entirely our fault because we're not the only spiritually sick people in the world. Of course we're not. But we tried to disregard the other person in column one involved entirely. Entirely. That no half measures here, okay? Means we're putting the wrongdoing of them totally out of our minds. We're just looking for our own mistakes. Where are we to blame? After all, this inventory is ours, not the other person's. Like, I could, you know, I'll tell you one way you could get people to do their step four inventories a little faster is if they were inventories of other people. I bet people would finish it in 15 minutes if that were the case. But we're taking inventory of ourselves here, okay? So when we see our faults, we list them. That's what we're doing in column four. We're going to put them before us in black and white. No rending of garments here. Just simple. Taking an inventory of damaged goods that are unsaleable that we need to be rid of. We admit our wrongs. Column four, honestly, right? Got to be honest. This, when the book says, and Bianca was talking about this earlier, the ability to be honest with yourself is an essential part of recovery. I think this is the first place that is really put to the test. You've got to be able to look at yourself honestly and admit your own mistakes. And you've got to become willing, no half measures on this one, to set these matters straight. And that's what we can list in column five, right? What are the contrary virtues we're going to be striving for? What are the mistakes? What would doing the right thing have looked like? And this is going to be very valuable when we get to steps 8 and 9. We'll talk about that later, okay? That's it. That's all you got to do. That's how you take a resentment inventory. And you can do this in, I absolutely believe you can do this in one sitting, right? Absolutely, you can do this in one sitting. And when you do, you'll have some new information about yourself. You'll see certain probably big mistakes that you've been making that are manifesting in this anger you're feeling towards other people. And you're going to have information about some blocks in yourself that are keeping you from the kind of relationship you need with your maker to direct your thinking, keep you out of that insane mental blank spot, and never trigger the physical phenomenon of craving. Okay? That's resentments. That's the number one offender. And if you could do that and get some mastery over that, boy, you're well on your way. So I said there were three. What's the second one? Fear. Fear. And manifestation of self number two is we're going to review our fears thoroughly. I'm going to do a simple five-column format for this too, because it's useful and it helps to have common terminology as we discuss our character defects later. So if you look at the next page of the workbook, Cameron's got it up here on the screen. We've sort of interpolated a five-column format. The book doesn't have exactly this format, but I think it makes total logical sense with the text, as you'll see. And we're going to ask very similar kinds of questions, okay? We're going to put our fears on paper, even when we don't have any resentment in connection with them. And I had some like that. You know, for example, I was very afraid of not having the kind of relationship with my son, just a little boy, that I wanted to have, right? I wasn't mad at him. I didn't have a resentment toward him, but I was very afraid of not having the kind of relationship with him that I wanted. So I put that down as a fear that I needed to deal with. And then we ask ourselves, why did I have them? Why do I have this fear? Right. And I can ask myself, well, you know, the kind of relationship that I have requires me to be able to spend time with them. And of course, it's an active, you know, alcoholic and an addict at the time. And so his mother wasn't too wild about that and so on and so on. And then I can ask myself the all important question. Isn't it because self-reliance has failed me? You know, I'm afraid of something, that it's always because there is something that I think might happen that I can't stop. Or something that I want to happen that I can't make happen, right? It's always something that I suspect may occur or not occur, and I don't find that agreeable, and I don't have the power to change it. See, if I could have forced everyone around me to behave the way that I wanted them to behave, I never would have felt afraid of anything, right? Because who could hurt me if I'm the Lord of the universe? If I'm the almighty sovereign and I can control other people, what would I have to be afraid of? But of course, I couldn't. I couldn't change other people's behavior. That's what I've learned, right, in that step three decision, is that my ability to play the director and get the other actors to listen to me, just a totally misguided project to begin with, of course, but I couldn't even, it didn't work, right? And so I feel afraid about what they might do because I know I can't stop them. Self-reliance has totally failed me in that respect. And so then in column four, I do the same thing I did in the resentment inventory. I look at where I'm to blame. I look at my mistakes. I start to think, you know, maybe my ability to have the kind of relationship with this little boy that I want to have is damaged by the incredibly disrespectful way that I'm treating his mother. Maybe my fear of not having the kind of relationship I want to have with him is causing me to become a bully with her and all the people around me to sort of try to get my way because I'm so afraid of what might happen if I don't. And they don't like that. And so that kind of bullying, egotistic pride is actually causing the very thing that I'm afraid of to happen, right? It's interesting, isn't it? It's a paradoxical kind of intention. And we look at that. And then I ask, of course, same as I did before in column five, what should I have done instead, right? Instead of reacting to this fear with a kind of bullying, how can I react in a way that centers my, you know, aspiring relationship with God? How can I place myself at his service? How can I ask him to do, to show me what I need to be doing in this situation rather than trying to bully and control everybody else in this situation and so on and so on. And we can just put that before us again in black and white. Very simple. And that's all there is to it, right? And again, you might be afraid of a million things. I learned actually well after my recovery that there was a bunch of stuff I was afraid of and didn't even know it at the time when I took this initial inventory. Just get the big stuff on paper. See why you're fearful. See what it affects, threatens about you. See where your own mistakes in that fear are and start to see what a different path might look like under God's employment. To get it before you, and it's as simple as that. That's the second manifestation of self, right? That fear. I'm not in control of the universe. I'm afraid something bad might happen. Now I need to be able to get a new relationship with that. So then manifestation number three. And this is all harms to others, right? Harmful conduct, including sex conduct, where many of us needed quite an overhauling. And I'm certainly in that category. But we're going to look at all harms to other people. We're going to review our conduct, as it says on page 69, the sex page. All of our conduct over the years past, all harms to others, including sex conduct, in other words. We reviewed our conduct over the years past and asked questions that should sound pretty familiar at this point. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been inconsiderate? Okay. And you can look, if you look at the simple five column chart we've got here, we're asking those questions. And those are our column four questions, right? So if I've been engaging in, for example, a harmful conduct toward a spouse or, you know, an ex-partner or an employer or a friend, whatever, where am I at fault? What am I to blame? That's like the first thing that I'm asking. I've been bullying toward this person. I've been dishonest toward this person. I've been lazy and not attending to my obligations that I owe this person, right? And who does that hurt? Who have I hurt by doing that? That's column one, right? So first I look at my mistakes and who they're hurting, fill out sort of those columns. And then what did I unjustifiably arouse? How did that make that person feel, right? If you take the example we were discussing with the resentment inventory, you know, obviously there's a harm to a spouse with this harmful sex conduct of having an affair, damages their self-esteem, unjustifiably arouses jealousy, resentment, unjustifiably arouses distrust, makes a person feel inadequate, right? It's like we're writing it from their perspective. You see what I'm saying? And that's what enables us to sort of see the manifestation of this conduct. And when we were at fault, right, just column four, This common format is what allows us to say things like, you know, column four as a general catch-all for the defects of character that we're sort of revealing with all of these inventories. So when we were at fault in column four, what should we have done instead? Column five, right? And that's what allows column five to become a general stand-in for all of the spiritual virtues, all of the spiritual strengths that we're going to be striving for. What should we have done instead? Get all that down on paper and take a look at it. Pen to paper. It's that simple, right? Would you believe me if I told you that's it? Because that's it, right? Three common manifestations of self. Who am I mad at? What am I afraid of? Who have I hurt? I ask myself simple questions about all of these things, and it enables me to get to the answers about myself that perhaps have been eluding me, although probably obvious to everyone around me, for years, maybe for my whole life. And absolutely, you can do this very quickly because look, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, no half measures, right? We've written down a lot, no doubt about it. We've listed and analyzed our resentments. You bet we have. That's the five column format that we used. We've begun to understand their futility, right? How absolutely futile it is to be mad at everybody all the time. What a waste of time that is. If you begin to understand that, you can answer, you can circle that and write yes. And of course, their fatality. One of the things that this chapter talks about is the wrongdoing of other people because it keeps me blocked off, you know, real or imagined, whether other people are really wronging me or whether I just think they are. If it keeps me angry and it keeps me blocked off from the kind of relationship with my maker that I need to have, it has the power to actually kill me, right? Because if I can't have that kind of relationship when I'm feeling angry and hateful toward everybody, and I need to have that kind of relationship to straighten out my thinking, and my thinking's got to get straight if I'm to get physically straight, then the wrongdoing of others, real or imagined, can kill me. So we've begun to understand their fatality now, right? We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We've listed the people that we've hurt by our conduct in column four, and have become willing to straighten out the past if we can. Straighten out the past, for example, by emphasizing those spiritual strengths and the virtues in column five. We'll have much more to say about that in steps eight and nine, of course. But one of the things we learn in the step eight and nine instructions is that when we take inventory is when we compile this list of the people that we've harmed by our conduct. This is the inventory step. This is where we do that assessment. So we need to do it here. So if you've already made a decision in step three and an inventory, and I want to slow down here again because there's so much going on here, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. This is one of the things that enabled me to experience freedom and recovery. Is when I was working with Cameron, I had previously attempted to do this fourth step several times. And I've been given the instructions, good instructions by people who believed in this book, who believed in this material and told me how to do it. And they told me how to do it the right way. And then what I did in all these occasions is tell me if you've ever done anything like this, is I'd start on the first day, maybe I'd start the next day, and I'd start writing and I'd be really going and I'd be feeling some relief. Right? I'd be admitting certain things about myself. I'd be seeing certain things and it'd be really powerful. And then I'd say, whew, boy, that's a lot for today. Let's stop and pick this back up tomorrow. And I'd put my little notebook down, put my little pen down on my dining room table, get up, make myself dinner, go to bed. Next day, wake up, maybe around 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. Oh, it's time for me to work on my fourth step. I'm going to work on that fourth step. You ever meet somebody and you ask them, how's your recovery going? They say, I'm working on my fourth step. Ooh, it's a dangerous answer. That's a dangerous answer because working on my fourth step means kind of drawing circles in the dirt with my toe. Maybe the next day I write another couple names on the list. Maybe I write, I can kind of see a little mistake in this one. And I just write like one little thing. I stop for the day. That's enough. That's enough for today. No need to recover too fast after all. Maybe the third day, maybe I work on it a little more. Maybe I say, I've been working so hard. I'm working so hard. I'm not talking to my sponsor again for, 4 or 5 days or whatever. Maybe I'll take today off, right? Just enjoy the sunshine. Hey, you got to have a full life, right? Maybe day four, you do a little more. And pretty soon, that invisible timer that's in my head counting down to the next time I enter the curious mental blank spot and convince myself it is safe for me to drink and get high. And I tell myself one of the two classic lies, this time it'll be different or this time it'll be worth it. One of those sounds convincing and I do it. And the alarm goes off with this timer that I can't even see counting down. I'm off to the races, the huge spree, everything we talked about in step one. Hopefully, in my case, I may eventually crawl my way back across the threshold of rooms like this one. Maybe I start over with a new sponsor. Maybe I talk to the same guy I was working with before. Who knows what I do? I get up to step four. And I start again. I take it nice and slow. This happened to me like, I think 3 or 4 times where I did this exact same process. And you know what made the absolute biggest difference for me? When Cameron and I were working together, he gave me these instructions exactly the way I've just given them to you, right out of this workbook, and said, all right, so get this done today. Let's talk tomorrow. And I'll hear your fifth step. And I was like, mind blown. One day, that's it. You do this in one day. Bianca likes to tell a story when she was working through this. Her sponsor said, why don't you call me in 3 hours? I'll be free then. And we can talk about this. Blew my mind. How can I do that? It's supposed to be thorough, right? How can I be thorough in one day? I've got to go back. I've got to, probably call my parents, get names of people I might've been mad at in elementary school. I got to think about everything I've ever been afraid of. Maybe I got to read my old diaries, see what I was afraid of when I was a little kid. No, you don't have to do any of that stuff. It is not necessary for newcomers to talk about every resentment or selfish act, every person they've ever harmed or lied to for the inventory to be thorough. That's not what thorough inventory means. It is not what it meant to the guys and the women who founded this program back in the 40s. They would do this quickly. You can see this all over the book. If you read some of the stories in the back of the book, like about AA number 3, they were doing these inventories in the course of one conversation. Dr. Bob worked with 5,000 people in his 12-step work, and he would often just do their inventory with them in just one day, a couple hours in his office, right? The objective is to get to causes and conditions. And sometimes it only takes a few incidents to show and make clear what kind of shortcomings have kept the newcomer blocked from intimate two-way relationship with the one who has all the power. It's something that this guy, Wally P., writes about in his book, Back to Basics. It's totally true. Folks, I was a bad boyfriend and a bad husband to a lot of different women, always in basically the exact same way. They were all, of course, individuals and things needed to be made right to each individual. That's individualized. But what is not, what was common is it was always the same. My character defects were easy to see on just a couple of these incidents. And if it's my character defects that are keeping me blocked from this kind of relationship and I can discover those fast, then shouldn't I want to be rid of them fast? Shouldn't I want to start making things right fast and start helping others fast? One thing I always tell people is, look, if you forget something on your fourth step, who cares? Because number one, if you forget about it, it probably wasn't that big of a deal anyway. Number two, if you think about it later, we have this step coming where you're going to do inventory for the rest of your life in step 10. So if you remember something later, I got good news for you. You'll still have a pen. You'll still be able to draw columns. There'll still be paper. We can deal with it then. But why wait to get access to the power until we have thought and we've made sure that every time I've ever been mad in my entire life has been committed to paper? That's foolish. And it would have gotten me killed if I'd keep going like that. So it only takes a few incidents. We're looking for, as the text says, our grosser handicaps, the big stuff. We're looking to make a good beginning, right? Because we're going to do this for the rest of our life. We're trying to start. We never really finish. We're trying to start. And so if we've done that, we'll have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. You just need to learn enough about yourself to start making progress and start to get better, okay? That really changed things for me. Now, look, you can't make a new person want to do this stuff fast, but I was desperate. It's one of the reasons I like to work with people who are just absolutely dying on the sort of end of their rope, is because I was desperate. And you know what? Even though I was given such a short amount of time to do it, I still basically procrastinated for like 23 hours and then in an hour did the actual work of writing it, right? Because of course, 90% of the time you're working on your fourth step, you're just thinking about your own stuff. You're watching TV. You're just putting it off. The actual work of writing a list does not take a long time. And so I really hope, and I used to worry about this. I used to think, was I really thorough? Was I really honest? And here we are, you know, been a while now, seems to be fine. So I really encourage you to embrace this. Step four is not a place you really want to be stuck at. So that's what we do. That's step four. See, it hasn't even been half an hour and you've learned how to do it so fast. You could do it. And if you just left the room and started now, you could probably be done in another half hour, although I suspect no one will do that.